It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Food Friday, our guest says great meals don't have to be expensive. We'll get advice on cooking on a budget.
First, President Trump announced his decision to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord yesterday, a landmark agreement between 195 countries to fight climate change. Trump said the U.S. would try to negotiate a better deal because he believes the current one imposed unfair standards on the U.S. that hurts workers and the economy.
Right now, the U.S. is the planet's second largest carbon dioxide producer, and the decision has put the president at odds with members of the international and scientific communities. In his speech yesterday, he said that even if the U.S. did go along with the promises it made to prevent climate change in the Paris climate deal, it wouldn't make much of a difference.
Even if the Paris Agreement were implemented in full, with total compliance from all nations, it is estimated it would only produce a 0.2 of 1 degree, think of that, this much Celsius reduction in global temperature by the year 2100. Tiny, tiny amount.
Jonathan Martin is a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, and he joins us now to tell us what the potential environmental impact of the president's decision could be. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Very nice to be here.
Well, as we heard yesterday, President Trump announced the U.S. would pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement. How big are the environmental consequences as you see it?
Well, I think they're potentially quite large. I think that clip that we just heard, the president saying about a 0.2 degree temperature decrease, that's in contrast to if business as usual continues until the year 2100, we have a range between 5 and 8 degrees Celsius temperature increase of the global average temperature, which is absolutely unsustainable in the sense that, the planet is not in danger of disappearing, but our way of life and our ability to feed our population and to water it adequately and all these other things that we've become accustomed to, that's in real peril if we end up with a 5 to 8 degree temperature increase over the next century. So this is a misleading statement by him. We're already at about a 2 degree C increase in the last 1.5 degree C increase in the last 150 or so years on the global average. So to bend it back to be actually something below zero would be a staggering accomplishment. And he talks about it as if it's a pittance.
Now, the U.S. initially committed to cutting greenhouse gas emissions by 26% to 28% by the year 2025. Can you put those numbers into context for us? So what would that have meant?
It would have meant a substantial change in the way that we do our main business of commuting and powering our economy. But it would have been gradually. It wouldn't have happened overnight. No one was advocating that we suddenly abandon petroleum products and use nothing but the so-called sustainable energies starting next week. But over a long period of time, if you can reduce your reliance on petroleum-based products, you change how much of an increase in the carbon dioxide level in the atmosphere that human activity has produced. It's been a substantial increase. We've never been at 400 parts carbon dioxide per million molecules in the geologic history of the Earth in the last couple of million years minimum, and we don't know for sure about further back than that. So we're in uncharted territory right now, and it's largely, almost entirely a function of human activity in the last 150 years. So to continue or to not curtail our use is going to exacerbate that problem. To actually rise to that challenge and meet those goals would actually begin to pull us back to a more sustainable environment.
Now, the Paris deal has a goal of keeping the global temperature from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius. As you said, we're in uncharted waters here, but can you try to paint a picture of the kind of climate scenario that 2 degree ceiling was looking to avoid?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and it's still a question of open debate. We're trying to figure out what does it. Here's the issue: a global average change in the temperature of 2 degrees is not exactly going to manifest itself as a 2 degree change in your average temperature in your backyard every year that goes by. So there are going to be certain places on the globe that will not warm at all. There'll be other places that will warm more dramatically. It would alter the circulation of the whole hemisphere, both northern and southern hemispheres, and that will, of course, impact the local distribution of weather systems and rain and various other types of precipitation that will come. So it isn't easy to know how a global average will manifest itself in the day-to-day travails of the weather. And that's one of the issues that's a really big question mark still, although we're getting further and further along in trying to answer that. And you sometimes hear people talk about more extreme weather events and, you know, more intense hurricanes as one particular type of weather event. And the connections between a global average change in the temperature and some of those scenarios is becoming a little bit clearer. But I would say, certainly as a weather scientist primarily, I would say that we're still not at a point where I feel really confident about those predictions. And that's a great uncertainty.
John Martin's with us right now, professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison, looking at the environmental impact of the U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accord. And, John, there has been, between the president and the scientific community, not speaking for everyone here, but there has been some tension. Some scientists saying that there has been a de-emphasis of science, that there's concerns about the way science may or may not be applied in the new administration. What does this decision by the president add to that tension?
Well, you're right. There is that tension, that sort of anticipation that things will continuously get worse from the perspective of our scientists and the energy that they devote to try and understand nature and then bring it to bear on the shaping of public policy. Will their enthusiasm wane in the face of an administration that seems reluctant at a minimum to take its advice? Quite contrary to the first Republican president that we ever had, Abraham Lincoln, establishing the National Academy of Sciences for the very reason to have science inform public policy. So we've gone a long way in 150 years. But that, it does increase the tension in the sense that we don't feel, I guess we get to feel more and more marginalized as what we're trying to help do for society, learning things about nature. And so that's one of the things that I woke up with thinking about today. When I was a five-year-old boy, my dad let me stay up way beyond a five-year-old's bedtime to watch Neil Armstrong make the first footprints on the moon. We rose to challenges then, and now we're shrinking from one. And that doesn't feel American to me.
Is that something you've seen? You talked about your own personal reaction. Have you seen that reaction with others in the scientific community, both in the state, in this country, and also globally?
I'd have to say in the state is the place where I've had much of my focus, particularly in my own department. We have one of my very esteemed colleagues who we don't want to lose people in our department. We don't want to lose people at our great university. But she has decided that in order to weather the storm that she thinks is coming in the next several years, she accepted an offer to go to another university. And part of the deal that she accepted was a fairly substantial research package, untethered to federal monies. And so this will give her a safe harbor for the next four, perhaps longer, a number of years. And so I don't think she's alone. I think that's probably a widespread concern.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Charlie joining us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I believe in that there is man-made influence on the climate and that there is climate change, and I don't deny that per se. But this Paris Agreement seemed to focus on the United States to make them the scapegoat for other countries. India and China, for instance, were not asked to have any real cuts in their production of carbon emissions and stuff like that. So why should the U.S. be part of an agreement that hurts itself?
Charlie, thank you for that call. And we have a clip of the president talking about that very topic. Here he is.
China will be allowed to build hundreds of additional coal plants. So we can't build the plants, but they can, according to this agreement. India will be allowed to double its coal production by 2020. Think of it. India can double their coal production. We're supposed to get rid of ours.
And I want to add here that PolitiFact noted in the agreement that countries, they have to declare how much they'll lower their greenhouse gas emissions, but it doesn't dictate what they have to do to get there explicitly. So technically, you know, they could build coal plants, I suppose. So, John, do you think that the president has a point there in saying that other countries are not doing the heavy lifting that the United States is or have opportunities that the United States is denied?
I think your comment just before, Veronica, was a really good one, that the agreement doesn't demand what what is the nature of your reduction. It just demands a reduction or challenges countries to a reduction. It's non-binding, so there's no demand. There's no imposition of anything on us or any other country. There's just a challenge set forth. The United States is not scapegoated as the, you know, the worst country in the world, but the United States has a unique leadership position in the world, and we can pretend we don't if we'd like, but it's not true. And I think when you're a team trying to fight a global problem, you really need to have some leaders, some particularly, you know, player coaches, if you would, who are kind of trying to organize the effort and make sure that it's moving forward. And I think for us to abandon that role that we've had since 1945 is not a smart move. And it's also true that whether or not China and India are going to be, you know, increasing their coal production as one of the means by which they power their economies, but under the context of trying to reduce their overall carbon emissions, they are therefore quite clearly involved in very high-level research on renewables. And China has made a huge investment in that, dwarfs the investment we've made in our country. And one of the fears I have about us pulling away from this agreement is that, shrinking away from the challenge rather than rising to it. I don't want some other country, namely China or India, to beat us to the finish line on really making renewables the wave of the future. Because if they get there first, we are their primary customer instead of them being our customers. Now, anybody who loves our country would realize that's not the place we want to be in.
John Martin is with us in studio right now, professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison, and we're looking at the environmental impact of the U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accord.
You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the president's decision to pull out of that agreement? Do you think it'll help or hurt the United States and the planet? Are you hopeful that the president will take other steps to protect the environment and fight climate change, or that, as seems to be happening, states and local governments might step up? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll pick up our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're picking up with John Martin, professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison, looking at how U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Climate Agreement will affect the environment.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the president made the right call by getting out of the Paris Climate Agreement? Do you think there will be major consequences? Why or why not? Do you think the deal was unfair to the United States? Are you hoping that the United States still finds ways to contribute to preventing climate change? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And let's go back to our calls now. We've got Dan on the line next in Green Bay. Dan, hi.
Yeah, I'd like to expand on something your speaker said earlier about, you know, possible winners and losers with climate change. Now, I live in Green Bay, so the frozen tundra, and I've read articles that, you know, maybe if we end up with a weather pattern in Wisconsin similar to, like, Maryland or Virginia, we might actually be a winner in that scenario agriculturally and the types of crops that we can grow, et cetera, et cetera. But if I lived in Las Vegas or Phoenix, you know, I might be really nervous about, you know, drought conditions and getting even hotter there. So I'd like your guess to comment on something like that.
Dan, thanks a lot. And John, what about Wisconsin? Do we know anything about how Wisconsin is projected to look?
Well, Wisconsin has a really, the University of Wisconsin and the Department of Natural Resources and other stakeholders in the state, some years ago, developed a program called the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts, WICI. And Professor Dan Vimont in my department is one of the people who is sort of a high-profile leader in that organization. And so what that group did is it sort of looked, and still does, it looks at what might be the impacts on the state of Wisconsin from some of the climate changes that are, forecasted by the state-of-the-art climate models. And the caller has a good point. Of course, there would be some positive sides to a climate change here in central Wisconsin, let's say the Green Bay area, where it's more like Baltimore as opposed to Green Bay from the 1960s. Yeah, that's great. You might have a few warmer days. There might be greater agricultural production. But it turns out that a lot of the fish in lakes and streams, and we have a huge tourist industry that comes from fishing and other kinds of outdoor activities in the northern and central part of the state, they are exceptionally sensitive to the water temperature. So if that water temperature goes up or down a couple of degrees, entire species are at risk. And so then so is your tourism industry. So, and I'm not saying that, I'm not saying that to, you know, to cause fear and alarm, but I'm just pointing out that this is a very delicate tapestry we're talking about. It isn't just what will the temperature be during the growing season. There are many, many different aspects to this sort of change, how it manifests even locally. And one has to imagine trying to deal with all of them, not just one.
All right. Well, thank you for that call, Dan. And now we go to Mike in Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I'm glad the president pulled us out of the accord. I don't think the accord really dealt with the base problem, which is the overpopulation. The United States will add 30 million more people in the next 10 years to this country. We've done nothing to become more ecologically, you know, efficient. We haven't cut a single high school football game out of the schedule. The Indy 500 is still 500 laps, not 499. We've created LED lights, but now instead of using them more efficiently, we're lighting up the candy aisle at the grocery store or every individual shelf. So we're wasting this wonderful new technology all in the sake of capitalism.
Mike, thank you for those thoughts there. And John, what do you say to that? We haven't done enough already. Look at that, says Mike. We're just as resource consuming as we ever were. And population control is not something that was tackled, he says, in the Paris Accord.
Yeah, I don't know about that or not, but I would think probably that's right, that that's not really a main issue in an accord that tries to deal with changing our habits about depositing things that we shouldn't be depositing at record levels into our atmosphere. So that's probably right. But I think if you stay in an agreement that challenges you, and again, it doesn't impose anything on us, it challenges us. If we meet the challenge, there will be littered along the way, along the path toward meeting that challenge, innovations that we can't imagine right now. That happened with the space program. Hundreds of innovations, technical innovations, many of which we use today. Everybody pulls a cell phone out to look at the weather, for instance. Both weather prediction and the technology involved in the cell phone had a direct connection to the space program. Who would have predicted that? And so I think if we reduce the urgency to meet challenges, then we certainly have the ancillary detrimental effect of reducing our likely innovations. So even just for that reason, I can't take issue directly with what Mike says, but I think I would take issue with the spirit of it. It's not a good reason to not be challenged just because you can't see any tangible evidence that you've made progress yet.
Professor John Martin is with us now from UW-Madison as we talk about the U.S. decision, President Trump yesterday saying the U.S. would pull out of the Paris Climate Accord. And we've got Jeremy with us next, calling from Racine. Jeremy, hi.
Hi, thank you. We cannot depend on Washington to do the right thing in regards to global warming and climate change. As much as we'd like to have them in our corner and be able to spearhead this, it's not going to happen. The Obama administration's got their fingerprints all over Keystone. It doesn't matter if you're Democratic or Republican. It just never seems to get anything moving forward in regards to global warming. It has to be a grassroots. Cities, states have to start taking accountability for themselves and start creating own legislation within their own cities and states to tackle this problem. It's not going to happen in Washington.
Jeremy, thanks a lot for that. And President Obama made a statement to that effect that local governments, states, private entities had to pick up the ball here and go with it and maybe could get the job done effectively there. What do you say to his point?
Well, there's no doubt that one has to keep the home fires burning, if you will. I think that's an important component to this whole crusade that we have to launch as a species. However, it isn't enough to say in Dane County we're going to do this, that, and the other thing to reduce our emissions, or in the state of Wisconsin, or in the United States broadly. This is a global problem, and in some ways it has dimensions that we've never, ever had to face before. Our current graduate population, that is people graduating college in the next 10 or so years, are going to be on the vanguard of a brand new challenge for which there is no script. And though it's true that this will be something that actually sustains its energy and sustains its drive to meeting the challenge from the grassroots level, it's different in a lot of ways. The grassroots will be grassroots done by people of means. For instance, people of means can buy an electric car. Somebody who is a little bit less affluent has to stay with that old Mustang. We have to make sure that we don't alienate people from the effort by suggesting that everybody should be involved in every single conceivable attack on this problem. On the other hand, we need some sort of federal and global organization to really make a substantial impact on what is a global problem.
And John, as we get close to the end, what do you think? Now that the U.S. has announced its intention to withdraw, from what I've heard, this could take about 4 years, puts us at about 2020 when we're at re-election. But do you think the center to this agreement holds? Do the rest of the countries involved stay committed, hold to their pledges, and make some progress without the United States?
I hope that's the case. I think that there's certainly incentives for countries that you might not expect to have incentives to do that. Some of the ones the president mentioned yesterday, China and India, they have real incentive, I think, maybe even enhanced incentive to stick to it and develop new technologies that will allow them to stick to it when the United States backs away. I really think that's the case. And so I'm concerned that though there'll be a benefit to the globe from those efforts, there will be a detrimental effect for us in the very long term because we won't be meeting this challenge with the urgency that I think spurs the innovation that will solve it.
And President Trump has said that he, quote, cares deeply about the environment. Do you see the U.S. still taking some kind of role, a leadership role perhaps, even though it is not involved in the Paris Accord?
No, I see no evidence at all that the president and the administration care about the environment. How could he possibly expect us to believe that when he appointed someone who's a climate denier? We don't know if the president is. He won't say. But he's a climate denier as the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, established by Republican Richard Nixon. There's no evidence at all that the president has any interest at all in the environment, and we have to call him out on that, which I'm doing now.
John, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Jonathan Martin, professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, joined us to look at what President Trump's decision to withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Climate Agreement could mean for the environment.
Great cooking doesn't have to be expensive. That's according to today's Food Friday guest. She's here to share some advice and recipes to help us cook on a budget.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have budget-friendly cooking advice to share or questions about how to do it? Call in at 800-642-1234.
Beth Monsell joins us now. She's the author of Budget Bites, over 100 easy, delicious recipes to slash your grocery bill in half, and founder of BudgetBites.com. Beth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, how did you get interested in budget-friendly cooking and sharing advice for others?
Well, it's kind of funny. It was all kind of by accident. This started 8 years ago. I had just graduated college and drowning in debt, like a lot of college graduates are. And I had pretty much whittled my budget down to bare bones, and there was only one area that I could cut back on, and that was food. But I really wasn't satisfied with the thought of eating beans every day or ramen noodles because I had just graduated with a degree in nutritional science. So I'm like, there's got to be a better way to do this. So I challenged myself to eat on less than $6 a day and started blogging about that journey and have continued ever since. Not necessarily $6 a day since, but the mission has continued for 8 years.
Well, like you said, I mean, it can seem as though your options get pretty limited. If you're looking at these beautiful cookbooks, like I love to look at, they're filled with, you know, Greek cheeses and herbs about all which I'll use maybe a tablespoon of and try to find use for the rest. I mean, can we cook that same quality, exciting food and still have it be cost effective?
Definitely. I think one of the main things that you have to consider is keep things simple. Food doesn't have to be complicated to be delicious or healthy. So if you stick to really simple ingredients, you can still get really flavorful food without having to buy, you know, 10 different items for one dish. And you can keep your budget really, really low that way.
And how do you come up with the recipes? Do you start with the basic food idea and then try to make it as inexpensive as possible? Or do you start with, you know, set yourself that budget and work backwards from there?
For me, I always start with what I'm craving, because if I don't crave it, then I'm not going to eat it, and then the food's going to end up in the garbage, and that's a lot of money down the drain. So I start with, hey, what do I feel like eating this week? I kind of look around at recipes, and then I do kind of try to whittle back the budget from there. I'm like, okay, what ingredients in this recipe make it expensive? And then I try to cut back or replace those ingredients with cheaper alternatives while still keeping the flavor.
Can you give us an example of one that you've been cooking recently?
Sure. Actually, yesterday I made some blackened shrimp tacos. And if you think about that recipe, it sounds like it's going to be expensive because shrimp are really expensive. But one of the things I do to design my recipes to be low cost is I balance the expensive ingredients with lower cost ingredients. So we have the expensive shrimp, which are going to be about $8 a pound. But I balance that with corn tortillas, which are super cheap, and a homemade coleslaw, and if you know, cabbage is like one of the cheapest things you can buy, and it's also really healthy. So you have a lot of inexpensive ingredients, a little bit of the expensive flavorful ingredients, and then you still have a great meal for a very low cost.
Is it a pretty common tactic you use where you've got an expensive thing, which is often going to be the meat or seafood in this case, and have that in as kind of a flavor ingredient instead of having big chunks of it?
Exactly. And a lot of times what I do with meat is I will cut back to half the amount of meat that people would normally use and substitute in beans or lentils in their place. So you're still getting a lot of protein, but you're getting more fiber, and they definitely cost less per pound.
And you also want your recipes to be not just, you know, budget friendly, but you want them to be pretty simple to make. Can you talk about why you pair those two things?
Well, I think one of the reasons people don't know how to cook these days is because they just don't have time to learn. So you have to have things that you can prepare in 30 to 60 minutes at the end of the day. But I also try to teach people to cook maybe one or two times a week and then eat those leftovers throughout the week. So what I do when I cook a big batch of something is I'll put one or two servings in the freezer, and then I have a rotating stock of dishes that I can just pull out of the freezer and microwave on nights where I'm just so busy or so tired that I can't even cook.
We're talking to Beth Monsell. She's the founder of BudgetBites.com, author of the book Budget Bites. She says we can eat and cook tasty food, and it doesn't have to cost a lot. And Beth, in your recipes, you don't see this very often on recipes, you've got the overall cost, and you break down the cost by ingredient. Is that kind of a nice warning sign for us to help keep track of our cooking budget?
Yeah, I mean, obviously everyone's costs are going to be different around the country, and even week to week prices change, but it helps people see the way each ingredient impacts the overall cost. So you see, if you use feta cheese, that's a super expensive ingredient, but that's why I only use 1 to 2 ounces for an entire recipe, not just a serving. So you still get that flavor, but you're going to keep your costs restrained.
You mentioned that you have stuff in your freezer for when you're tired and you've got a pantry. What are some of those staples that we should have and should freeze?
I love to have a variety of frozen vegetables on hand because that way all the prep is done. They're usually always chopped. Nutritionally, they're very great. I mean, they don't usually don't have any extra sauces or anything. You just have to make sure you look on the label. But they reheat really quickly, and you can toss them into soups and stews and pasta to up the nutritional value of whatever you're eating. I also like to keep my meat in the freezer. So what I do is if I see a meat that's on sale, or that's reduced price because if it's a larger quantity, I'll buy that, divide it up, freeze it, so I can take out a little bit of time for each meal that I'm having.
It's good to know one of the recipes. You shared a couple of what you said were some of your most popular recipes with us. One of them is Spanish chickpeas and rice. We've got this at WPR.org, by the way, and linked on the Central Time Facebook page. And I understand this is one you'd had trouble trying to replicate paella. And this isn't paella, but it's in that same ballpark.
Yeah, definitely. And this is also a great recipe because it's vegan. And it's one of those recipes where people don't realize they're eating vegan. It's just naturally that way, but it's still super flavorful. You've got your beans and your rice, so you're going to be really full, and you've got all your proteins, fiber. It's a great dish. You've got a squeeze of fresh lemon on there at the end, which really makes the flavors pop. It's awesome.
And how does it keep over the week if you make kind of a big batch?
That just keeps very well. I find rice and beans keep great for, you know, 4 or 5 days. Again, I would probably stick a serving or two in the freezer. You want to keep the lemon separate while you're reheating it and then just squeeze it over top afterwards. But other than that, it's going to stay great.
And that one you're using canned chickpeas. And I got to say, for a while, I was like, oh, I've got to do it from, you know, dry beans and soak them and cook them. And it takes hours. And I've definitely come over, for the most part, to the canned bean side of thing. Because, you know, I'm not always thinking ahead that far. And I want to make something that I can eat in 40 minutes, not tomorrow.
Right. And I think that's important, too, is you have to balance it for your lifestyle. One of the things I do with beans, though, when I do have a chance to cook them from dry, is I will put them in the freezer. If you keep them in the cooking liquid and then freeze them that way, like in a refillable plastic container, it's almost like having canned beans because you can just pull it out of the freezer, defrost it really quick, you can run water over it in the colander, and then you've got your beans ready to go. So that's a great option. And using a slow cooker to cook beans makes it really easy.
Do you think that the slow-cooked beans or the non-canned beans taste better than canned beans?
It just depends. You know, sometimes I actually prefer the canned chickpeas over fresh because they do have a little bit of salt in the liquid and it just kind of makes them taste good. But other times I like the slow-cooked or home-cooked beans just because they don't have that extra kind of muddy flavor in the background. It really just depends on your preferences.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Kyle is with us in Racine. Kyle, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I was just calling in to talk about how much money I've learned to save with using neglected vegetables. So vegetables that people don't really use that often. So things like collard greens, mustard greens, turnip greens, rutabagas, turnips, all that kind of stuff that, you know, isn't very glamorous, but, you know, they all taste great, very nutritional. And you can find them for, you know, you can find a bundle of turnip greens for like 99 cents at the store. And, yeah, so
Kyle,
yeah,
thanks.
Finding things that people don't use that much.
Kyle, thanks for that suggestion. Beth, using those neglected vegetables, Kyle says.
Yeah, and, you know, another reason those particular vegetables are going to be really cheap is not just because they're neglected, but they're very shelf-stable. So I always recommend to people stick to those hardy vegetables, not the ones that are going to be really soft and spoil easily, because the ones that have a longer shelf life are naturally just going to have a lower cost.
And we're talking right now to Beth Monsell, author of Budget Bites, and she's sharing easy and budget-friendly recipes and cooking advice.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have some advice to share on saving money in the kitchen? What kind of dishes have you come up with that everyone likes but don't cost too much? Or do you have a question for our guest about how to do this yourself? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post and find a couple of our guest recipes on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in a little bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're talking to food writer Beth Monsell, the author of Budget Bites. And she's telling us how to make great food on a budget.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about cooking on a budget, or do you have some advice of your own to share? Have you found a good way to save money on your cooking? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post and find some recipes on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take our first caller. We have Adam with us in Glendale. Adam, hi.
Yes, hi. I run a small concrete countertop business in Glendale, and I'm always in the shop, and all I have is a microwave. So I'll take ramen noodles have done a lot of things. They have home-style noodles, different ramen noodles. So I'll take a can of, like, chunky soup and mix it with the ramen noodles. Or today I'm mixing some leftover lasagna that I had with the ramen noodles. And it tastes awesome, and I've never seen anybody do it.
Interesting. Okay, Adam, thanks for that. And Beth, what do you think about a technique like that, combining foods like this?
I love it. I think it's great when people do whatever they need to do and what works for them, because it's going to be different for everyone. Even though I said I don't want to eat ramen noodles every day, there is a lot of really cool stuff that you can do with them. And I like to upgrade my ramen noodles. So instead of putting like a can of soup, I'll just take whatever leftover vegetables I have in my refrigerator, whether it be like a handful of spinach or some leftover mushrooms, and toss that into the ramen noodles. And instantly, it's a whole meal. I like to put an egg in there a lot of times, too, for some extra protein. And it's super cheap.
Thanks for the suggestion. We'll go now to Sharon in Minocqua. Sharon, hi.
Hi. Another great program. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
I grew up in the South. I'm from New Orleans, and we had kind of a ritual of having Monday was like either red beans and rice or black-eyed peas and those beans are so inexpensive. But most of the time in the South, they're cooked with salted pork. So to forego the salted pork, I've made a recipe just using, especially with black-eyed peas, it's now my favorite to use curry. And, of course, with any bean dish, you can't make a small batch. You have to make a giant batch. So you have lots of leftovers, and as the leftovers get to taste better and better as the longer they get to kind of sit in the juices. So black-eyed peas are so inexpensive, and even the organic versions of the black-eyed peas are not that expensive. But there's ways to cook without the salt, without the meat and the pork and stuff. But,
Sharon, thanks a lot for the call. I want to bring Beth, and this hits close to home for you, right, Beth? You're in New Orleans yourself, is that right?
Yeah, I am, and I have taken a lot of cues from the culture down here as far as making inexpensive meals. I love the idea of making, you know, the beans without the pork. I've done that as well. One of the ways I substituted the salted pork in my red beans, I made a vegan version, is I used smoked paprika to mimic that salty smoked pork flavor. And then I added a little bit of coconut oil because it's got that nice saturated fat that kind of tastes like an animal fat. And so you've got all those flavors in there without using the salted pork. And that was a really cool thing.
And that begs the question, is it cheaper to just eat without the meat, to eat at least semi-vegetarian?
Yeah, most of the time it is. I mean, I can't lie. You know, if you think about most meats, they're going to be in the, you know, $4 to $6 range for the cheaper meats, $4 to $6 per pound. And vegetables are running, you know, $1 to $2 a pound. And beans, they're going to be less than $1 a pound. So it definitely is cheaper to cut out the meat. But I enjoy meat, so I do work a little bit in. But I probably eat 50 to 75% vegetarian.
That said, the other recipe we've got up on the Central Time Facebook page, you've got a one-pot sausage and sun-dried tomato pasta, and that's using a little bit of Italian sausage, again, a little bit as flavor to go a long way there.
Yeah, and that's another great recipe because it's a one-pot skillet pasta, so it's really easy to make on a weeknight, and what you're actually doing is cooking the pasta in a broth with the other ingredients, so the pasta really absorbs all the flavors in the dish, and it's super fast. You've got one dish to clean, and it's just the perfect weeknight meal.
And that's up on the Central Time Facebook page, along with the recipe for Spanish chickpeas and rice. And we're talking now with Beth Monsell, author of Budget Bites, over 100 easy, delicious recipes to slash your grocery bill in half. And she's also the founder of BudgetBites.com. And we take our caller now. We've got Mary joining us in Milwaukee. Mary, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say when I would prep my lunches for a week, I would just add a pound of ground beef to the old-fashioned favorite of green bean casserole that most people make at Thanksgiving. And it basically makes for lunch for a couple of weeks, and it's freezable.
Oh, good idea, Mary. And there's another one, adding an ingredient, and you've got something a little more hearty. How about that, Beth?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea, and I love the fact that she makes them 2 weeks ahead of time so that she really cuts down on the prep work, because that's really what holds a lot of people back.
Mary, thanks a lot for that call, and we'll go next to Rich with us in Viola. Rich, hi.
Hello. Yes, I would like to suggest joining a CSA. That gives you an opportunity to actually buy some vegetables that then can pre-design your meals, and every week you get a different basket full of different vegetables, and of course they're fantastically fresh, they're organic, and they're also you know, locally grown. So lots of times when you look at the economics of what it costs for those vegetables, you're paying a lot less, of course, for transportation, and you're actually paying the farmer that grows it rather than all the different people in between the farmer and you.
Rich, thanks a lot for that call. And Beth, that reminds me, cooking with the seasons, using the veggies that are available at that time of year, I imagine you can come out a lot cheaper.
Oh, yes, absolutely. In addition to seasonal cooking, like the caller was saying, things that are grown in your area, because they have less distance to go, they're going to be cheaper just because the transportation costs are less. So keep those two things in mind, well, actually three things, when you're looking at vegetables and fruit and other produce, is you want things that are hearty and not going to spoil fast, things that are grown close to you, and things that are in season. And if you look for all those three things, you're going to get the best price for your produce.
And Beth, does it pay to buy things in giant batches? And if you find, you know, if you maybe if you go to one of the stores that sells in bulks, you can buy a ginormous case of beans or something or rice. Does it pay to do that, or do you end up kind of getting tired of that ingredient?
You know, it really depends on what types of things you cook the most. I do a lot of rice, so I do generally buy rice in large quantities. And then it depends on your storage. For a long time I lived in a one-room apartment, so I didn't have storage, so it wouldn't make sense for me. So it really is a case-by-case basis, and always double-check the prices, because a lot of times at those big bulk stores, they might be a big package, but the price is exactly the same. So it depends item to item and person to person.
Rich, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Beth, the idea of making a big batch of stuff and eating it over the course of a week has come up a couple times, and I've done that. And I got to say, day three, day four, a little bit of burnout starts to set in. I'm like, again with that stuff, it was good. But how do you beat that?
Yep. So that happens to me too. But like I said, when I cook a big batch, I'll always stick just a couple of servings pre-portioned in the freezer. So when I get to that day three and I'm getting sick of what I cooked that week, I can change it up by grabbing something out of the freezer and get a little variety in my week so I don't totally get sick of what I've cooked.
And Beth, can you share something else that's been inspiring you recently with your cooking that you wanted to create on a budget?
I'm always really inspired by dishes from around the world. There are so many incredible flavors in other cultures, and they're becoming more and more available in the U.S., and I think that's really fun. So stores like Trader Joe's and Whole Foods, they really make those products available so I can experiment more with flavors and different dishes, and that's been really fun for me for the past couple of years.
And then are you inspired a lot along that vein by your local food in New Orleans?
Yeah, a lot. We have a really good melting pot of cultures here now. It's not just the Cajun and Creole. We have a lot of Vietnamese, so I love dabbling in their flavors. We have a large Hispanic population, and I absolutely love their cooking as well. So it definitely has influenced my recipes.
And we've got another caller on the line. We've got Hillary at 800-642-1234. Hillary is joining us right now from Dubuque. Hillary, hi.
Hi, what a great program. I have three suggestions. One, buy a slow cooker, make it your best friend, because that way you can buy the cheapest cuts of meat. Usually, thyme and liquids make all the difference with a cheap cut of meat, and you can make it taste much more expensive and flavorful than it would otherwise. Two, if you have windows wherever you live, you can do window box gardening, even on the inside. You can grow fresh herbs. Make fresh herbs your friends, because they're incredibly expensive if you buy them in little precious boxes in your produce department. You can grow them pennies for packets of seeds and have fresh herbs. And then the third point is spices, dried spices. You can buy them in big bottles, cinnamon, cumin, coriander, and make spices, dried commercial ground spices to your friends.
Hillary, some great ideas there. Slow cooker, that's slow cookers have been catching on again in the past several years. She says buying cheap cuts of meat and window box garden for your herbs, growing your own herbs and dried spices. What do you think of those tips, Beth?
I absolutely love my slow cooker, and one thing that people should know is that you don't have to get a really fancy, expensive slow cooker with timers and pre-programs. My slow cooker costs, I think, less than $25, and it has three settings, low, high, and warm, and it has done me well for, 15 years. It's great, like I said, for cooking beans effortlessly. Like she said, the meat, I absolutely love slow-cooked meat. There's so many things you can do with a slow cooker, and it's great for big batches for when you do want to put things in the freezer and save for later. So, yes, that is my one appliance that I recommend to everybody.
Beth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Beth Monsell, author of Budget Bites, over 100 easy, delicious recipes to slash your grocery bill in half. She's the founder of BudgetBites.com. You can check out two of her recipes, Spanish chickpeas and rice, and one-pot sausage and sun-dried tomato pasta. We've got those over at WPR.org, and you can find a direct link on the Central Time Facebook page.
So you probably saw it coming, but now it's for real. Cheese is officially the state dairy product here in Wisconsin.
It all went down on Thursday when Governor Walker signed the bill making cheese the top dog when it comes to Wisconsin dairy.
Big surprise probably wasn't that bill, but probably was the fact that cheese wasn't already the state dairy product. I mean, we even have a state soil, so why not a state dairy product? And Rob, you do know the state soil, right?
I should, and I'm blanking on it right now.
I believe
it's not red granite. No, that's the state mineral.
I believe it's Antigo silt loam.
Oh, yeah, it is. That's you're right.
Right,
thank
but
you.
Cheese. It's interesting that it's not a type of cheese, though, just cheese.
Cheese in general. And I assume there's got to still be pushback from the frozen custard faction of the state. I mean, then you could make a case as a unique thing. But yeah, I think cheese, a lot more widespread appeal there. Milk is the official beverage of Wisconsin, right? Milk itself.
It is, and the dairy cow is already the state's official domestic animal. So we've got a lot of bases covered here when it comes to dairy.
Is there a part of the problem? Oh, and lactobacillus, isn't that the official microorganism, the one they use to make cheese?
That's a joke, right?
No, I believe there was. They were trying to do that. I've got to go look that up. Yeah, so I think we've got every step of the cheese-making process covered now.
You're listening to Central Time. Enjoy that cheese.